Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It is now 8:08 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steel Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. Don't forget about the next hour, Center Stage, All Things Arts and Entertainment. We want you to know all about it, so stay tuned. I'm so grateful to be back with you. It's been a couple of Sundays, maybe even three. Shaletta and Susie Jones actually filled in for me, so I'm really, really grateful for them. So I want to say thank you for your patience and receiving me back. I have to tell you, this week we have seen the president call his former defense secretary a big dumb mouth. We have also seen a newly sworn in Democratic congresswoman went and said a very nasty word about impeaching the president when she was talking about that. And so the big question is always, has our civility been lost forever in the era of President Trump? And George Goins explores this very subject in his latest book, Civility Lost, The Media, Politics and Education, and he's joining me now. Mr. Goins, or Dr. Goins, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And am I saying your last name correctly?
Yes, it's Goins, and you can call me George.
All right, George, thank you. Now, you are a prominent author, dynamic leader, recognized educator, and featured speaker. You have worked with public and private sector organizations on leadership selection, development, and assessment, which I'm getting a master's degree in leadership, so I'm really excited to talk to you tonight. And so you've had the experiences. You know that it really starts at the very top. Whatever happens with the leadership, all else goes under that and changes. And so civility walking out the door and this nastiness to one another walking in has been a real challenge for me to watch, and I feel helpless, like I can't do anything about it. How do you feel watching this happen?
Well, it's fairly disgusting, actually, because I think all citizens are equal participants in our democracy, and as part of that, you have to have a dialogue and you have to have conversation, and yes, you do have to have debate because not everyone's going to agree on policies. But to resort to incivility and not treating people respectfully, calling names, pretending they are enemies rather than rivals, and castigating the others in harsh language is just not appropriate.
It's so true. Enemies versus rivals. You
right.
know, it used to be a time we're used to that. That's the, you know, it's that give and take all the time when it comes to politics. But it is not that anymore. I was just trying to talk about that a moment ago, asking now that the Democrats have the House in D.C. as well as in our great state of Minnesota, and the Republicans have the Senate, this should be a time of them saying we have to come together to make this work. Yet that's not what I'm hearing. It's not even what I'm hearing from the callers.
Oh, that's correct. I mean, 75% of people in a poll said the cause for incivility is politicians. 69% indicate that the internet and social media are part of increasing incivility in the United States because people can lock into websites. They don't have to use their first and last names. Plus, they can connect with people in their silos, mm-hmm. and their belief silos, mm-hmm. and they only talk to people with whom they agree. And in addition to that, the news media, according to the poll, 59% of people thought the media is also responsible. That includes newspapers and others. So this concept of winning over your enemy is a very negative aspect in politics. And in a lot of facets of life today, and it's unfortunate that we cannot get together and discuss issues as we should. The last time I think the whole nation came together was in a crisis in 9/11, and I think if you were around at that time, you could understand how people felt about being an American and being a citizen and being in this together. that has fractured as time has gone on, and it appears that the only time we can come together as citizens is in a crisis like that, and that's not actually what has to occur. And we can't expect the government to change its ways and to make our lives more civil. My book basically is indicating that that's up to us. Incivility is the cure to incivility is the general population beginning to listen to each other, talk to each other respectfully, and to try to find common ground when we disagree. And that doesn't appear to be what happens in Washington, D.C. or the state capitals today.
I know that social media has a lot to do with it. It has given a rise to anger and hate having a very strong voice. But at the same time, it's given people a chance to really voice who they really are. I am one who I like to know who you are. You know, I want people to know who I am. I want to know who they are. So there's a part of that that I don't mind. But when I look at my life, I was very, very young in the 60s. And that reminds me of the times when we really were at opposite ends then, that hatred was alive and well during the civil rights movement. And it continued on until like 69. So as I watch us today, it reminds me of that time, which became very violent. It was just awful. We lost so many greats during those few years. And so I worry today, I'm very concerned that we are going to see that happen again, that the violence is going to continue to rise. We're starting to see it. We hear about it in the news. But a lot of people think it's not in my backyard, so why should I be concerned?
Well, I agree. I was around in that period, too. And it was very raucous, very violent. And it became a severe problem on university campuses and across the country, actually. And I think where we're heading now with people talking to themselves, the people they agree, and castigating others is not any way to solve a problem. And I think we have to somehow find ways to listen to each other. Very simple things, actually. Being able to actively listen to each other, which means you understand the content and the intent of messages. Mm. And oftentimes, with text messaging, I always tell my granddaughter, I don't always understand the intention of what you said in your text message. Was it to be sarcastic? Was it to be humorous? Was it to be poignant? And I think even in coffee shop conversations, listening and understanding not only the content, but the intention of the content that the person is expressing to you is very, very important. You have to find a way to have a dialogue with people so you can find out if there are any shared meanings and whether or not you can find some common ground where you can come together and find some resolution of these problems. When you talk to people individually, whether it's Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, or liberals, you'll find that frequently they are concerned about the same issues. And frequently you'll also find out that there are places where they can come together. And there are going to be places where philosophically maybe they can't, but at least they could make progress on those areas that are of mutual concern. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we just see verbal hand grenades being thrown, indicating that the other party is immoral. And that's an interesting statistic, too. 47% of Republicans see Democrats as immoral, and 35% of Democrats see Republicans as immoral. And it's interesting to see that people in the political parties are looking at the other persons in the other party as not behaving in moral or have moral attitudes towards the policies. And that's a breach that is going to be difficult to solve.
It is going to be difficult to solve. In fact, in my small world, what I do know is that this is something that has to begin with children. I think that we've gotten to the point of no return, that it's going to take another generation to bring back civility. Maybe it's the classes. You know, we all had to take civics classes at one time. Maybe we need to take a civility class and try to help us get back to who we once were. Even if it was just for a small time in history, it was a really important time in history because people wanted to do better. They wanted our country to be better. They wanted us to stand out among all the other countries in the world. And here we are, global citizens, finally. And this is where we land. I'm absolutely disturbed by it all.
Well, I'm disturbed, too. I write a bit about education in this book as well, because When I was in high school, we did have to take 4 years of English, 3 years of math, 3 years of science, and 3 years of social studies or history. Mm-hmm. We did study the basic principles that undergird our democratic republic. And if you don't understand those principles, it's going to be hard for you to be an active participant in the political process. When I was writing the book, I told a friend, I'm quoting Justice Scalia in my book. And he said, well, I'm a liberal. I'm not going to buy that book if you got Scalia in there. And I kind of laughed, and I said, actually, Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg were very good friends. But Scalia wrote an excellent book for lawyers, by the way, about how to make the case at the Supreme Court. And he said it's very simple. You have to gain the trust of the other party, and you do that by fairly representing the facts, honestly characterizing the issues, owning up to those points that cut against the position that you're taking, and addressing them forthrightly and showing respect for the intelligence of the person you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And that's not a conservative view or a liberal view. That's just a proper view for citizens and others to get along in a democracy, to self-govern by following those ways to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, on television and a lot of the cable channels, all you see are the talking heads taking one position or another. They talk over each other. They don't listen. And the whole idea there is to castigate the other side, which mm-hmm. is unfortunate. I do remember a long time ago where two people would sit down on different sides of an issue and have a conversation, and you could hear the arguments both sides make, and you could make sense out of their positions, and you can determine that both of them have a point to be made, and then decide for yourself which way to go.
And those that were watching and listening, that's what we were waiting for, the point that needed to be made. However, now we get together. You talked about trust. Trust is fleeting like happiness these days. You know, it used to be that if you trusted in someone or you trusted who they were, their reputation preceded them, then you honored that. You came to the table saying, I trust you. And they would have to prove differently in order for you to change that, right? Today it's different. Today you don't trust at all. We get to the point where those talking heads, all of the political analysts that are talking, there are so many of them that don't agree and they don't trust one another and they roll their eyes and so we're watching a fight, right? A philosophical fight right there on television, which gives us permission to have that same fight at our dinner tables and with our neighbors and with the students, and it goes on and on and on. So where do we begin the recovery?
Well, I think you begin actually in public schools and on television too, because even on some of the policies that are proposed to solve some of the problems, it's going to be an upside to them and a downside. And I ran a school district, so as a school superintendent, and there were things that we did that were well-intentioned, but every well-intentioned policy that we proposed always had a downside to it. And I think public officials have to discuss issues and policies and say, if we implement this policy, it's not going to be a miracle that's going to make everything better all the time. There could be some issues that may be problematic. A very interesting one is the case against Harvard in terms of affirmative action, mm-hmm. where in good intentions they want a more diverse student body, but in doing it, the allegation is that they discriminate against Asian students. And so I think having those kinds of discussions and taking a look at that, I don't think anybody's opposed to having a more diverse university system, but how you do it is not going to be problem-free.
Yes, but we will never, ever be able to satisfy all the people all the time. It's impossible. It's almost like there are people standing in line, right, that are different from you and me. You and I are probably, you know, as different as can be. But, you know, it feels as though because we are this incredible soup, we're no longer just, you know, a pot of diversity. We're one. Our genealogies are crossing, and we're learning that we're more like each other than ever before, yet we can't stand one another. I still can't figure that out.
Well, what happens in politics is we slice and dice people. Arthur Schlesinger, who was the historian in the Kennedy White House, wrote a book in the 90s, I believe, where he said what's happening is we're replacing assimilation with fragmentation. and we highlight the unum as opposed to the pluribus. And what's happened there is you'll see it in the news. They'll say a particular issue before Congress or the courts is a woman's issue, or they'll say it's a racial issue, or they'll say it's an issue dealing with senior citizens. And what that communicates to people, really, is that if I'm not a senior citizen, if I'm not a minority, or if I'm not a woman, I may not pay much attention to it because I think that issue doesn't concern me. However, if they would highlight the issues as issues concerning justice or equality or goodness, and identify the value behind those issues, I think more people will take stock and not fragment these issues into demographic categories. I think we don't look at ourselves, except during these crisis periods where we stand up and say, I'm an American. We look at ourselves as a hyphenated American, and we're all human beings. That's the thing that we are all. Everyone is a human being. Mm-hmm. Those other kinds of categories kind of differentiate how we look or where we came from, but the real category is we're human beings, and you should all treat human beings in the same way and quit slicing and dicing people for political effect.
So true. Dr. George Goins, can you stick with us for a few minutes? I'd like to let people know where they can get your book.
Oh, sure.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. It is now 8:27 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. We are talking with Dr. George Goins, and he has written a book, Civility Lost, The Media, Politics, and Education. Let me just read you a sentence. In the book, he's talking about media. This is near the beginning. It says, what has happened is narrowcasting, not broadcasting. Now Americans talk past each other and retire into their media echo chambers, reading only articles or pieces that agree with their politics and philosophy. Besides the echo chamber, sources, citizens confront other challenges. And this is why I am intrigued by this book. I don't know about you, but I'm running out to get it. I hope you will, too. Dr. Goins, we sure appreciate you joining us tonight. Where can people get the book?
Well, they can get it on Amazon and pre-order it, and probably other bookstores as well as the publisher, Roman and Littlefield. And if they want to contact me, they can contact me at on my website, georgegoins.com.
George Goins, that's GOENS.com. My final question for you, sir. In your research for this book, did it change you?
Well, it actually solidified some of the feelings I've had for a long time. I used to be a history teacher, too. And I understand the importance of people being able to have a dialogue and a discussion and sometimes a debate about contemporary issues if our society is going to exist as it has in the past. That's what a democracy requires, is a free expression, but civil expression. And that's a fundamental, and I see that sliding away at times, and it's just alarming.
I don't know if we will ever get back to who we were, but I do pray and hope that where we are going brings us back to civility. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, sir. I hope we can call on you again.
Thank you very much.
All right, good night. Leadership, education, accountability, that's what he talks about. That's who he is as a leader and an author. If you get a chance to pick up the book again, it's called Civility Lost, The Media, Politics, and Education. I am absolutely curious to know where he places the blame, if at all. All right, you're listening to Steele Talking. I am your host, Geraldine Steele. Coming up next is our last guest for this half hour, and I'm excited about this. Kevin Dostal Dower, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. He is responsible for the safety of University of Minnesota students who travel abroad. And I don't know about you. You've been hearing different things about Turkey and other places that are on, you know, the list, whether it's Syria, and the president has talked about, oh, now there's a travel ban in certain countries. So I want to know, how often does this happen, and what other countries are on the list, and what does that mean to students? And we hope to get all of that from our next guest in just a moment. It is now 8:35 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking, and I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. Has the political climate in the United States made it risky for Americans to travel abroad? It is a question, isn't it? And it's a question that we need to address because several new travel warnings have been posted by the U.S. government in recent weeks. How concerned should we be? Well, let's talk to Kevin Dostal-Dower, who is responsible for the safety of all University of Minnesota students that travel abroad, as he is their Director of International Health, Safety, and Compliance. Welcome to WCCO, Kevin. How are you?
Very well, Geraldine. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
We sure appreciate it. Okay, first of all, tell me how much you love your job.
I absolutely adore my job. It is a wonderful job.
You know, that's a lot to that job. Is it all that you expected it to be?
And sometimes quite a bit more, actually. The fun part about my job is you just never know what's going to happen day to day. And so there's no real routine to it, which is exactly how I like it.
I wonder how you keep up with it all, because it is ever-changing day to day.
There's a lot of reading the news, a lot of paying attention to where our students are trying to go, where our faculty and staff are trying to go as well. So, like I said, it's engaging because it's new every single day.
Have you seen a shift at the University of Minnesota in students maybe not traveling abroad as much as they used to?
You know, not really. The university remains among the top 10 institutions for sending students to study abroad. We send on average somewhere around 5,000 students total abroad annually for various reasons, not just study abroad, but across the whole system. Mm-hmm. So we're not really seeing a dramatic shift in the numbers. There's been a little bit of a shift. It's been a short-term trend so far, so we're kind of watching it just to see in destinations and types of locations where students are going, a little bit less to Europe at some times, a little bit more folks looking for, you know, Australia, New Zealand, locations like that. But it's too early for us to tell if that's going to be a part of a longer-term shift.
Yeah. You know, as we look back on high school, I remember how desperately I wanted to go to Paris, and my mother could not afford to send me at the time. My father had been killed by a drunk driver, and it was really mm-hmm. difficult. I wanted so desperately to go. But what I found was that a lot of students didn't get a chance to go. There were very few. Both my children traveled in 7th and 8th grade, one around Spain, one all over France. And, you know, for them, it changed their lives for the better, right? And I wish every student could travel abroad. Yet today, some parents are really weary about where they can go and where they should go.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And I absolutely support your sense of the importance of international travel. I mean, one of my favorite quotes of all time is Mark Twain's quote, where he says, you know, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely in those accounts. And I completely understand the reasons why, you know, given what international news focuses on, why some folks are a little bit more hesitant or nervous about how things have changed in the world in the past decade or so. But, you know, in reality, the trends aren't really held up by what we see in the media all the time. This is not, despite the prevalence of terrorist attacks that we see on news media and the amount of attention that they get, it's not really dramatically that much statistically less safe to travel abroad now than it was in previous decades. And so I do encourage, and I get the chance to talk to parents all the time, I encourage them to really look past the news headlines and look a little bit deeper and learn a little bit more about what's going on in the locations where their students might be interested in going, or perhaps to look at some different locations around the world. I mean, there's lots of different places in the world to travel that, you know, where perceptions can be different in terms of the level of safety, or, you know, what's going on there, you know, either politically in country or, you know, with other factors that might be impacting safety or security in particular locations. So, we certainly don't want, you know, an overall sense of the world being a more dangerous place to get in the way of our students looking at opportunities to really have that life-changing moment that you talked about.
Well, you know, this new generation of college students, they seem to have no intrepidation. They don't seem to have any worries about traveling. Have you seen that commercial on television where there's a young woman who looks to be about 20, 21 years old? She's traveling alone. She meets a man. The next thing you see is that they're dancing someplace. And yeah. I thought to myself, okay, I'm all for that. There are five generations that are working together in the workplace, and all five are traveling today. So I love that idea. But at the same time, we know that there's someone behind that, like you, who is making sure that the advice is given, that safety rules are being looked after, that you keep up with what is happening around the world. So tell me the day in the life of Kevin Dostal-Dower.
Well, you know, a majority of my time actually is spent on preparation, education, and training for students to try to get messages to them before they go abroad. But You know, unfortunately, the population that I work with, 18 to 24-year-olds, generally speaking, tend to view themselves as somewhat invincible, and those messages don't apply to them. And so it can be difficult to get through the real messages about situational awareness, especially, and maintaining, you know, avoiding a sense of complacency when they start to feel comfortable in a place and start to feel like they've got a place all figured out. You know, I talk with students often about what I call my peanut butter benchmark, which is, you know, when the students find that one supply, that one thing that makes them feel like they're at home, that becomes one of the more dangerous times of their study abroad, because they get complacent about their safety. They don't have the same type of situational awareness that they do when they first gotten off the plane, and they start to feel like, oh, this is a very different environment. I really need to pay attention to what's going on. And sometimes, you know, length of time in country does not equal safety and security for our students, because they do become complacent. But yeah, it's difficult to get those messages sometimes to a population of students who, you know, do feel like, you know, the world is their oyster and they can go anywhere and try anything and do anything. And unfortunately, I think that is supported a little bit by the, you know, the phenomenon of overposting on social media and the idea that I'm going to try to get the best selfie of myself, or, you know, try to, you know, get a picture or get a video that no one's seen before, so I can, you know, get more likes on social media. And that can cause our students some challenges sometimes. And so it is an issue of trying to get them educated and trying to keep that situational awareness throughout their time abroad.
Not easy to do. I don't envy you at all. But what is the number one thing that you tell them from the top and say, if you don't hear anything else, hear this?
Well, I mean, part of it is that situational awareness piece, but the main message that I tend to send to our students is that, you know, terrorist attacks happen here and there. They happen randomly. You're never going to be able to predict or avoid something like that. The bigger concern I have for our students, and by far the higher prevalence of incident for our students, is basic petty theft. It's you know, not paying attention to where they put their backpack when they sit down in a restaurant, or when they're in a tourist location, not paying attention to the people who are around them. You know, pickpockets often work in teams where, you know, we're going to just distract you over here while we're picking your pocket over there. And it's those basic things that sometimes our students don't think of as the main concerns. And again, so that situational awareness piece is the main message that I try to get to students, where, you know, they need to recognize that in many places where our students travel, you know, the display of a smartphone can be the display of wealth or a symbol of inequality that, you know, can be worth more than what somebody in that country might be making over the course of a month. And so our students have to be careful with the way that they display themselves. And again, that doesn't mean that all U.S. American travelers are, you know, rich, wealthy, and viable targets. But it's certainly, you know, the perception can exist that way when our students are going around using very expensive smartphones or using, you know, displaying other things that maybe put them in a position where they're viewed as a target, even though they might not be. So, you know, those types of messages about basic crime. I mean, the fact that, frankly, the number one cause of injury and death for U.S. citizens traveling abroad is road accidents, it's traffic accidents, whether they're driving a car or whether they're hit by a car crossing a street where they don't understand traffic patterns. Those more basic things are the things that don't make the media headlines, but are really the bigger concern for my health and safety team as we're working with our students.
When it comes to what they should read before they go, what do you suggest?
Well, I'd love,
you know, just to increase the cultural intelligence, because the challenge is a lot of our students have, you know, we're locked in these suburbs or these small communities, yeah, where we feel so comfortable with our everyday things of, like you said, putting down a backpack and taking out your phone and sitting it down. It's no big thing. But when you go to travel, there are lots of books that really tell you how to increase your cultural intelligence, so you know what is happening around you, or you know what to expect when you see this or see that.
There are, and I mean, I think there's any number of guides can be very helpful to students. There's a really useful guide called Culture Smart, which, you know, students can pick up for any country around the world for like $7 on Amazon. But, you know, really what I'd suggest for students to read before going is the local newspapers of the place where they're going. Know a little bit about what's happening, you know, both in a political standpoint, but also, you know, what are the concerns of that location where you're traveling? What are the things that are going on? What are the hot topics? You know, it's a safe bet to think that most of our students are going to be interacting with people who know more about the U.S. than our students know about the location where they're going. And so just, again, a little bit of understanding about what is the cultural context of what I'm going to, and that can be usually gained simply by reading an English printed newspaper from the location of where they're going. So reading something like that, I think, would be a critical cultural informant type message before they go. But yeah, I mean, there's any number of cultural guides that they can pick up to certainly increase their cultural understanding of the place they're going. But that news, that current events knowledge is really the piece that I would suggest for our students.
I agree with that. But what about translators? If you can't get a hold of an English, one of those newspapers in English immediately, yeah. And people are using translators and really trusting them. That's something we didn't have when I was in high school.
Well, and that's something I think our students need to be a little bit careful about, too, because there's any number of, cultural challenges that our students can find themselves in because of a mistranslation given by Google Translate or other translator, apps. So I think there's those can be taken a little bit with a grain of salt. I mean, that's another piece. It brings up another piece that I think is really important for our students. I do think that it's important for our students to gain just a little bit of basic language skill. If it's nothing more than what I would call travel survivable language for that particular location, I think that can be very beneficial just for our students to have a basic understanding of not only how to greet somebody and how to ask for something on a basic level, how to ask for help, how to ask where things are. These are skills that can be picked up with just a couple of hours, and maybe that's even asking too much, of pre-study where, students can understand. And again, when you do a little bit of basic language understanding like that, you understand things like how important it is when you walk into a shop, for instance, in Paris, to greet the shop owners there. I can't tell you the number of our students who will tell me that the shop owners in Paris are all rude. They won't even talk to you. Well, that's because the cultural understanding in a place like Paris is that when you walk into the shop, you greet them. You say hello, you say bonjour, and then you will get a different level of service than if you walk in and just start looking around. And so, I mean, I think that cultural understanding piece that comes with just a little bit of basic language learning is also really important for our students to do as their advanced work. And by the way, going back to the newspaper piece, there's a fantastic website called paperboy.com where students can go and find English-speaking newspapers in just about any country in the world.
Ah, Paperboy, huh? That's a website?
Yeah.
Hey now, paperboy.com.
Yep.
I'm going to remember that. Both of my children have traveled. My son was over in China just last year, in Hong Kong and Shanghai and other places. And my daughter has been to West Africa and kind of all over. And I have to tell you, the big thing for me is to know where they are. I want your papers. I want everything. I want to know what your flights are, who you're staying with, what communities are you in. I want to know as a parent. Is that too much to ask?
No, I don't think so at all. I think actually, I mean, it's always good for someone else to know where our travelers are. Hopefully that's us so that we can track them down in case of an emergency. But, sharing itineraries with folks who are left behind or who stay back home, sharing basic information like that, making sure that you've got basic copies of things like passports and credit cards kept somewhere electronically or with folks back home. Those are just basic good travel safety sense ideas. I think, we get calls from parents all the time who say, I usually talk to my son or daughter every day or every 2 days or something like that. And I haven't heard from them in 3 days or 4 days or 5 days, and I'm really concerned. And, when we do eventually track those students down, nine times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, they've just gone on a weekend excursion somewhere and just haven't told anybody behind. And so I do think that's just good basic travel sense. And I think that goes beyond, frankly, college students traveling abroad. I mean, that goes for any international traveler. I think it's a good idea to let somebody know what your itinerary is. No, I don't think that's asking too much at all. Whether or not that message gets through to our students as a measure of safety and a sense of security for those who are worried about them back home, again, can be a different question, but that's not asking too much.
What countries are we seeing or hearing that there is a travel ban on or a travel warning?
Well, I should maybe start by just clarifying a little bit about the travel warning process. The U.S. State Department used to use travel warnings until about January of 2017, and they've now shifted to a travel advisory system. And there's a sounds like semantics, but there's a critical difference between them. So before January 2017, the State Department had essentially what you call a click-on, click-off list. You were either a travel warning country or you were not. There were 43 of them in January of 2017. But when they made that transition to travel advisories, there's now a State Department travel advisory for every country in the world. Every country in the world is rated by the State Department on a 1 to 4 scale. And one being, exercise normal precautions. But, you can imagine this is your places like Canada and Argentina, Chile, places that are generally viewed to be relatively safe for travel. Ireland is a level one, for instance. You know, and they go all the way up to level four. And level four are those, you know, the places where we, even the university, generally doesn't recommend travel, which is, you know, places like Syria, North Korea, not that we can get, you know, students into North Korea anyway, right, at this point, but, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, places like that, that generally tend to be more, you know, high risk and high tension areas. So that's, I think that's an important distinction to understand, that there aren't really any new travel warnings at this point. The State Department does do updates to their travel advisory system on a regular basis. And so, you know, the two that I know have made the most news lately certainly are China and Russia. And what's interesting about Russia, that made a significant amount of news back in December when they changed the travel advisory for Russia, but they actually downgraded it from a level three to a level two. And so they've actually, the State Department has actually opened up travel a little bit more in Russia. Certainly for the students here at the University of Minnesota, they no longer need to go through a travel approval process to go to Russia. You know, China's made a lot of news in the last week.
Yes.
But again, China's travel advisory was a level two before they updated it. And the State Department is committed to making those updates annually. Well, it was about a year since China's had been updated. And again, that the information that they've added to the travel advisory for China is really updated information that's helpful for our travelers to understand. It's, you know, it's in relation to things like exit bans and things like that that have been a little bit more in the news. But the State Department, by its level, has not really stated that China is a more dangerous place to travel now than it was even 2 weeks ago. So I think that context of the travel advisories is important for your listeners to understand, that it doesn't necessarily mean, when you hear it in the news, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a new thing. They've updated some information, but there's no reason for our travelers to think right now that it's more dangerous to go to China than it was even a few weeks ago. Now, I think if our students have made particular comments against the Chinese government and have been, you know, out there protesting and making themselves known as anti-China, then I think obviously there's context that is important for travelers to understand that, you know, there might be detentions, there might be questionings that happen as a result of their travel there. But that the risk can be much more contextual than what the news media presents.
And final question, when it comes to international health, what you should do, where you should go. Of course, everyone should know where the embassies are. I want to start with that. But what do you tell the students and the parents when it comes to international health? Do you check with the CDC? I know I do whenever I travel abroad to make sure that there are no warnings or if there are diseases that,
right,
you know, are happening at that point. So tell us a little bit about international health.
We do recommend that our students are looking at CDC warnings and guidance in advance of their travel. You know, really more important, again, on that education preventative side is for the students to visit a travel clinic before they go and to get an understanding of what the recommendations might be for vaccinations or concerns with that particular location. You know, are they traveling to a location where it's recommended, for instance, that they sleep under mosquito netting to avoid exposure to malaria, things like that? You know, are there yellow fever vaccines or other vaccines that would be important for them to go? You know, all University of Minnesota travelers travel with a medical insurance plan that includes everything from, you know, basic routine gastrointestinal checkups, which is frankly what most of our travelers experience when they go abroad, all the way up to, you know, full-scale medical procedures, et cetera. And so we really would recommend that all travelers make sure that their medical plan, whatever it is, covers them internationally. Again, you know, university travelers are required to have a policy like that, but your average traveler should really look into what their medical insurance would cover, and then be aware of what facilities and what resources are available in country. And there's any number of websites where they can find access to local clinics, local hospitals, et cetera. I think a little bit of advanced knowledge, a little bit of advanced work on finding where they might go in case of medical emergency can be really beneficial to travelers who find themselves in a difficult health situation. And you know, unfortunately, you mentioned the embassy. I certainly think it is a good idea for our travelers to know where the embassies are. The embassy is probably not going to be super helpful in terms of a medical emergency. You know, and sometimes the U.S. embassy isn't always the safest place to go. If the students are in a country where there is a, you know, a protest or something about U.S. government foreign policy, maybe going to the U.S. embassy isn't going to be the safest idea. And so we put plans in place for our students to be ready and able to shelter in place where if they need to in a hotel or in student housing or things like that. So again, safety is contextual there. Sometimes the embassy can be very helpful. Sometimes the embassy will be overwhelmed with other things that are going on, and it might not be the best place to go. So, but mostly advanced preparation, again, getting our students to think ahead about what their medical needs might be and how they would address them if something did come up.
And have you traveled abroad a lot?
Yes, many times, both for personal and professional reasons. And it every time I go, I learn something new, both about myself and about the place that I'm going. And I look forward to my next trip every time I come back from the next one.
Oh, I tell you, I am so grateful that I've had the opportunity. Kevin Dostal-Dyer, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to reach out to you or learn more about what you do and how you do it, what do they do?
They can reach out to me through the University of Minnesota. I work at the Global Programs and Strategy Alliance on the university's campus. I don't necessarily know if I want to read my email address off here, but if that's something that you can put on your, make available to folks there, I'm certainly happy to have them do that. Otherwise, they can reach out to our GPS Alliance main phone number, which is 612-624-5580.
All right. I really appreciate you coming on tonight and have joined our discussion. Thank you, Kevin Dostal-Dyer.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. It is now 8:57 here at WCCO. Welcome back. Just wanted to say very quickly that if you want some ideas about, what you should do when you're traveling abroad, you can go to Travel and Leisure magazines. They have articles even online, like 12 tips to make international travel easier. And those are the things that we should really pay attention to. And don't forget how important it is to know these things, like taking a hotel business card, right? There you go. Then people know you know how to get back. We're out. We'll be back with Center Stage in a moment.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.